And you're listening to Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I am here with my lovely co-host, Ron.
Oh, I'm lovely this morning.
Yeah,
that's
you are.
Nice. Yeah. Very nice.
Okay. Yeah, it's very good. So it's a very exciting morning because we're going to have a very special guest in just a minute or two. First, I have to introduce her. So we're going to have Carla Bartolucci on. I am so excited. We get to talk about gluten-free stuff and einkorn again. Carla and her husband Rodolfo founded Jovial Foods, and they met in the 1980s in Bologna in Italia, where she was spending a year abroad studying Italian, and he was studying agriculture, and they were both born into a family of talented home cooks, he in Italy and she in New England, and food was at the center of their childhoods. Carla has written a wonderful book called Einkorn, Recipes for Nature's Original Wheat. She came across einkorn when she was searching for an alternative grain to for her daughter Julia, who was diagnosed with gluten sensitivity. The only wheat in existence that has never been hybridized, einkorn grew thousands of years ago in the Fertile Crescent. Einkorn has remained unaltered for thousands of years, which allows many, including Julia, who suffered from mood swings, asthma, and digestive problems, to eat wheat without symptoms. Amazed by her daughter's health transformation, Carla became a champion of this little-known, nutrient-packed grain. So I'm going to bring up Carla here, and I'm very excited to have her on the air. Welcome, Carla, to Radio Naturopath.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you back. We had you on a couple of years ago, and now we can catch up because some things have changed.
Things move along here.
Yes, they really have. However, it was so long ago that it would be fine with me if we reviewed
Sure. All
the wonderful information you had given us a couple of years ago, because we talked about your foray into gluten, avoiding gluten, and also the bringing of einkorn into popular culture and bringing it into the United States.
Sure, that's great.
Right. So tell me, what started you, first of all, on your path to being interested in gluten-free items?
Well, I think my husband and I started working in the health food industry about 20 years ago after my parents had passed away with cancer. So we were always interested in eating better. And at that time, in the 1980s, people in the health food industry were starting to say that wheat was bothering them, and a lot of people were eating spelt.
Yes.
And so my husband and I sort of followed suit with that. I also learned how to make sourdough bread, and then my children were born, and they were eating like us, but my oldest daughter was, pretty much showed signs of food allergies. She showed signs of food allergies, and we had seen a pediatrician, took out dairy, took out eggs, took out soy, and eventually her symptoms kept getting worse and worse, and I didn't think that it could be wheat because she was eating spelt, eating sourdough, and eventually a doctor diagnosed her with gluten sensitivity, not celiac disease.
Right.
So we tried to find a way to discover what was the oldest wheat, thinking that maybe it wasn't her, but it was something about the wheat that people were eating today.
Uh-huh.
And we heard about einkorn through a group of researchers in Italy, and we met with them and learned more and more about the grain, and actually were able to get some seeds from some local farmers and started to grow the grain ourselves.
Where were you, and you were growing it in Italy?
We were, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And eventually what happened was we took out all types of wheat, including emmerich spelt, from our diet, and our whole family began to eat einkorn or gluten-free. And pretty quickly we noticed a very significant improvement in my daughter's health. And within about 2 months, a lot of her symptoms started to disappear.
So even though she was not, she was able to eat einkorn, she wasn't able to eat spelt. And, you know, if you talk to, if you look at William Davis, who wrote Wheat Belly, he talks about all the problems with modern wheat. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is spelt doesn't quite have those problems. And yet Julia had problems with spelt.
Interesting enough, we also had access to emmer, which is even older than spelt.
Right.
And that really aggravated her symptoms, too.
That's interesting. So emmer is a little bit hybridized from einkorn?
Emmer came along about 2,000 years after einkorn, and it has two more sets of chromosomes. So it was hybridized in nature. And it's basically the grandfather of durum wheat.
Right.
Whereas spelt is was the origins of the bread wheat that we eat today.
I see. So a lot of times people who do well on einkorn might not do well. Obviously, Julie didn't do well on spelt or emmer.
She didn't, and some studies have shown that einkorn is really the only species of wheat that's missing in certain types of gluten proteins.
Uh-huh.
So for us, that was really the way to go, and within 2 years, she had a complete health transformation and really blossomed into a different person.
So and Julia never, she didn't have, so she was tested, like she was tested for tissue
right.
transglutaminase, and did she also have a biopsy, an endoscopic biopsy?
A blood test was negative, and we stopped
right.
there.
Okay. Yeah. So she had no tissue transglutaminase, no gliadin antibodies, and yet she was horribly sensitive to gluten.
She was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what kind of symptoms did Julia have?
She started really young with, you know, stomach upset and skin rash. She had a rash on her face. She had a bloated stomach. She had mood swings. She had very large tonsils. She had, her nose was plugged up. She snored at night. She had. Then she started to get really bad headaches every day.
Poor little kid.
And yeah, and then eventually her hair started to fall out.
Ugh.
I know. Yeah.
And how old was she when this was going on?
We started to give her einkorn when she turned 7.
Uh huh.
So she was sick basically from, you know, as soon as she started eating. Actually,
right.
You know, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, poor kid.
But she's doing really well now. She's 17.
And, wow.
Yeah, and she looks great, and she feels good, and everything is well. So you can heal your body from food allergies.
Yes, absolutely. It's really great. Mm-hmm. So that's fantastic. So you have this company, Jovial, of course. And I remember when I was looking at I was looking up Jovial, I thought, oh, this is a really edgy company. They have gluten-free products, and they're also producing einkorn. They must be out in California. And I looked it up, and it said Franklin, Connecticut. And then I found you, and then it turned out I had met you before, which was so funny.
I actually was a patient of yours when I was pregnant with Julia.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Yes.
In Mystic.
Many
that's
years
right.
ago.
That would have been in 99 or 2000. Mm-hmm. Well, it would have been 2000 because she's 17 years old.
Exactly.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's just tremendous. So Franklin isn't a thing anymore.
No, we are now in North Stonington.
That's right.
Yeah, we moved to a beautiful property. Almost a year ago, and some people who are local to Connecticut might remember Randall's Ordinary.
I do, because that year, so I worked with Deirdre O'Connor from 1999, from June of 99 to August of 2000, and at Christmas time, she took us to dinner at Randall's Ordinary.
It's a great place. I used to eat here a lot myself.
Right. It's a beautiful place.
It is. The property, now that we've been here for a year, is just as beautiful as I remember it.
Right.
In the sense that the buildings need to be renovated, but the land is, it's a special place.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's down North Stonington, as I recall. Is it off of Route 2?
It's off of Route 2, right off of I-95.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, so you also, aside from producing einkorn, your company makes gluten-free products as well.
We do, because Julia also really liked to eat gluten-free, to tell mm-hmm. you the truth. She
yeah.
loved rice. She liked gluten-free breads, and it was something that made her feel good.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to try to, you know, give a different nutritional profile to gluten-free foods because I do cooking classes and in meeting people who were eating gluten-free and had celiac disease, I felt like they were just satisfied with something being gluten-free, but they weren't looking past that. They were in a position of weakness, like they felt like they weren't in a position of strength, like they were taking over their diet. And since they had an immune disease that was curable with food, I felt like it was a good thing to try to have people look at their food in a different way. So instead of looking for a piece of bread that might look like a piece of regular bread and sort of make you feel like you're replacing it, I felt like we could offer nutrition on top of that. Because the truth is when you're a manufacturer and you go behind the scenes and you see things, how things are made, you realize that maybe some of the gluten-free foods that are out there aren't as healthy as they should, they could be.
There was an article that came out recently. It made the international news, and it made me really angry. It was a couple in Britain. It said they had put their child on a gluten-free diet, and then ultimately the child died. And they didn't talk about causation or correlation. Mm-hmm. They just said it made it sound like if you go gluten-free, right, you could be reducing your ability to get nutrition.
No.
And I'm like, listen.
Right.
People on paleo diets thrive. I mean, I support the eating of grains, if people eat them and they feel good eating them. And some people don't do well with grains. And the people who don't do well with grains who stop eating them thrive. So weren't telling the whole story.
Right. I think everybody's different.
That's
and,
right.
It's important to find what is right for you. But I also find like there's a lot of food fads, and I feel like people don't have time. Sometimes don't feel like they have time to prepare the right foods for them, and they end up kind of in a spiral of different type of diets, and I don't think that's healthy. So I feel like, you know, if you're on a gluten-free diet, it doesn't just mean eating, you know, packaged foods or
that's
things
right.
like that. It means, you know, maybe having some grains that are just in their natural state that are gluten-free, and making sure you're eating, you know, the right diet for you, whatever that might be.
Right. And one of the things that I see repeatedly in my practice is people don't eat their veggies.
I know.
And I see that over and over. I'll get a child that comes in that's constipated, and the parents are trying to help the kid with their constipation. And you come to find out that she doesn't like vegetables. And they're trying everything to try to get the kid to eat vegetables. And if you raise a child, if you start a child off eating very reinforcing foods that are starchy and sugary and fatty, they're a lot of times they're going to reject vegetables.
Right.
That you have to start raising them from early on, saying this is food.
Mm-hmm. And what's different with the gluten-free flour that I've developed is it doesn't contain any added starch. So normally gluten-free flours have up to 40% added starch.
That's very interesting. What kind of starch do they usually add?
They use tapioca or cornstarch or potato starch. But we don't have any starch, until now, I don't think people really thought you could make anything gluten-free without starch, but you really can, and it can come out light and delicious.
Wow.
And we also utilize 80% ancient grains in the formula. So a lot of times gluten-free flours will be heavy on white rice and starch and things like that.
Yes.
Where we're using teff and millet and sorghum and, you know, to add some protein and fiber and actually add some flavor to gluten-free flours.
So that's going to be more nutritious than your average gluten-free flour that you see in the grocery store.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And Jovial has things like pasta, and you have cookies, and you have them in both einkorn and in gluten-free.
We do. We try to make both. We also have we're also interested in glass jarred products to avoid the cans. So we have tomatoes, we have olive oil, obviously, and we also have a new line of jarred beans. So instead of being in a can, they're in the jar.
Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's really good. Then you avoid the whole can lining issue and the possible xenoestrogens, the foreign hormones. Very good.
And we also try to avoid added things like ascorbic acid or citric acid, or in our tomatoes we don't add salt because we don't really need them. So we handle the farming. My husband and I are heavily involved in that. And if you have really good raw materials, you don't really need these added additives that aren't so healthy sometimes.
That's wonderful. All right. So where do I want to go next? Let's see. So einkorn. Please explain to us exactly what einkorn is. What's the difference between einkorn and modern wheat?
Einkorn is the original wheat. so it grew hundreds of thousands of years ago.
What does Einkorn mean?
It means one grain in German.
Yes.
Okay. And the reason why it's called one grain in German is because of the way it looks. It modern wheat is kind of clustered around the wheat stalk, whereas Einkorn is grows flat on the so it's one grain attached, one by one. And it's the oldest wheat that grew in the Fertile Crescent hundreds of thousands of years ago, and it was the first seed that the first farmers planted when they transitioned from hunter-gatherers to farmers during the Neolithic Revolution.
That's neat.
Mm-hmm. And it basically was farmed, and then it ran out, and then it basically was replaced by amer and spelt during the Bronze Age. So those other wheats yielded more, maybe it might have been easier to grow. And Einkorn slowly grew out of fashion and was nearly extinct when my husband and I ran across these researchers.
So who saved the seeds?
Well, the researchers collected 1,000 packets of seeds from seed banks around the world, and then they sprouted some of them, and then they took the ones that were really Einkorn and they grew them until they could replenish. They found a variety that was very authentic, and they replenished that. It took them 12 years to get enough to plant 50 acres of wheat.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So so you are growing. So tell us biochemically, as much as you know, the difference between modern wheat and Einkorn.
Well, Einkorn has one set of chromosomes, two sets of chromosomes, which is the original. When the grains were hybridized, they added more chromosomes. So
right.
Genetically, it's different that way. It has a very weak gluten, and so some people find it easier to digest because it's missing in some high molecular weight proteins that other wheats contain. So that's basically, you know, the simple way of putting how it's different. And then when you use the flour in your kitchen, you can see many different changes, many different differences, like the color of the grain. It's a deep yellow, orangey color because it contains a lot of tocotrienols, lutein, carotenoids.
That's really good.
Mm-hmm. It also has a lot of B vitamins and trace minerals, and they're actually those, when you see enriched flour, it's those nutrients that are added to regular wheat flour that Einkorn happens to be very, very rich in. It also has different, when you get down to the molecular level, the starch granules of Einkorn are very small. So when it's ground into flour, they don't burst open. So Einkorn doesn't absorb water as quickly as regular wheat.
Right.
And so you can feel the difference also when you're baking with it. But it does have enough gluten to be able to bake really great bread and wonderful pizza and all those things that people like. So it's a great alternative in the sense that it's very nutritious. It has 30% more protein and 15% less starch or carbohydrates than regular wheat. So it's satisfying and it tastes really good.
It really does.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah, what I've gotten from you, I've gotten the pasta, which I eat, you know, about once a week, because I don't eat a lot of pasta, but when I do, I don't eat a lot of pasta, but when I do, I choose Einkorn from Tobiel. but I do, and I like to do it the night before a big bike ride. That's how I'll carbo load with it.
Yeah.
And it does, as you said, it tastes really good, whether you put pesto on it or you put red sauce or you just pick at it and eat it. It's just really yummy.
Yeah.
And I also get the cookies. The last cookie I bought was the checkerboard ones.
Yeah, those are everybody's favorite. Yeah.
Yeah, they're very good. And we still haven't fed it to Ron because we're not clear if Ron has celiac disease or not.
Yeah.
Because when I took Ron off gluten, he didn't have health insurance. So we weren't able to do his antibodies. So we don't know if he has celiac disease or not. Mm. And we've thought that we might try him because, you know, he had all the same symptoms, except you didn't have the hair loss, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But you had basically a lot of the same symptoms that little Julia had. Your biggest symptom was digestive.
Correct.
Digestive and joint pain.
Right. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right. Yeah. And when you went off gluten, that all went away.
Wow.
But of course, you know, Julia was eating spelt and she was eating emmer and she still had those symptoms and she eats Einkorn and she's fine.
Right.
The other problem that I have is if I, for any reason, decide to, or not decide to, but accidentally ingest wheat, I get pretty violently ill from it now.
Yeah, that happens to her, too.
Yeah, so yeah. It's not worth the test.
Well, I don't know. It might, but the thing is, it might be worth it to test Einkorn, because that would tell us if you have celiac disease or if you just have the same violent gluten sensitivity that Julia has.
Well, sometime when I have 2 days that I can not do anything.
Well, we do have these sourdough crackers, and they're really small, and they're made with the sourdough process. It's 24 hours, so it's really healthy type of snack. And if you did want to try, I would recommend, you just eat one of those, maybe.
Because they're sourdough. So tell us the difference between sourdough and regular crackers or bread.
Well, sourdough is the oldest way that they made wheat, which is bread. And it's just a mixture of flour and water that ferments. It contains probiotics and enzymes, and it pre-digests starches and proteins in flour. So it really creates the healthiest type of baked product. And, that was replaced by active dry yeast or commercial yeast, which moves things along really much quicker when the baking industry came along. And so I had the idea of making an Einkorn product with sourdough. And I found a bakery in Bologna that's over, they've been baking bread for 50 years and we're familiar with sourdough and we're using ancient grains. So I asked them we developed together an Einkorn cracker made with my sourdough starter.
Of that, that's really neat.
Yeah, so sometimes people want to try. They've been off of gluten for a long time, but they're not celiac disease, and they want to try Einkorn. And I always recommend just eat one cracker, and then if you feel okay, eat two, and the next day, and then see what happens for a week. I feel like your symptom, if you really are celiac or extremely sensitive, and Einkorn is going to bother you. It will bother you. So, it's a good way to test it. But
right.
We've had so many people write in and contact us every day and say, I had wheat. My son had an actual wheat allergy. There was one woman. I don't know if you know the difference between an allergy to wheat. But he had a wheat allergy, which is kind of rare. And he was fine with Einkorn, which was great news. With children with autism and just a lot of different, there's a lot of different health issues that can go along with a sensitivity to wheat.
Yeah, what I tend to do is if I test somebody and they have a positive tissue transglutaminase or they have a positive anti-gliadin antibody, I don't recommend Einkorn.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if you've heard of any people who do well with Einkorn who have those antibodies positive. I've been nervous about that.
Yeah, people don't really get into that much detail.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm wondering if there are people who actually have tissue transglutaminase or gliadin antibodies, because when I see that, I'm like, listen, you're gluten sensitive, get
right.
off gluten. I tend to not tell them to do Einkorn, but if people know that they're wheat sensitive, but I see that they don't have antibodies, then I encourage them to try Einkorn.
Right, it's hard. There isn't really a test for gluten sensitivity, so there's no biomarker.
Well, it's true. Because if you go deeper into reading about gluten sensitivity, one way you can be gluten sensitive, of course, is to have the tissue transglutaminase situation where you're making antibodies to the lining of your digestive system that's cross-reacting with gluten, with modern wheat gluten. And then you have gliadin antibodies where you're actually making antibodies to gluten itself. And that's one way of being, you can see those antibodies in certain people. I definitely have patients who do not have those antibodies positive who are definitely gluten sensitive. So just because we don't have a test for it, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Exactly.
And they don't test, for example, for the zonulin pathway. And the zonulin pathway is a pathway that gets stimulated in everyone when they eat bad glutens, and it's just a matter of degree. And the zonulin pathway messes up your villi. It messes up the tight junctions of the places where you absorb your nutrients on the brush border of your small intestine. And so that happens to everyone. I wonder if it happens at all or less with Einkorn. I've got to believe that it does. And I know that when I eat Einkorn, when I eat modern wheat, I don't feel well within half an hour. And for me, it's just I feel sad and sleepy, and my digestion is a little bit off. Nothing big, but it doesn't quite feel right. I get none of that with Einkorn.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
You did bring up an interesting point. I think a lot of times people self-diagnose and they'll kind of eliminate something, and then, you know, but if there is this testing, you know, so many tests that you're talking about, I think it can help people pinpoint closer what is their sensitivity.
Sure.
You know, so I think that's important.
Well, and the other thing that I do is if somebody has the antibodies and mm-hmm. then they go on a gluten-free diet, I'll test them periodically after that and say if they're having a problem, I'll see that they still have antibodies and then I'll help them to tighten their control. So Einkorn is so fascinating to me. You wrote a whole book. You wrote the book Einkorn, I can't see, Recipes for Nature's Original Wheat, which you can get from Amazon, and you probably can get at bookstores and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's really great that you did that. So Einkorn, are you growing Einkorn in the United States?
We aren't.
Okay. Right, so you're growing it in Italy, right?
We are. We actually tried to grow a little bit in North Stonington, but in New England, it gets really damp in the summertime, and
right.
that's just not the greatest thing for wheat.
That's the problem.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you'd have to grow it out in the Midwest somewhere or someplace
where
it's
really
fairly
dry. We like to grow it in Italy because we have an interesting group of farmers there that have some really pristine land that's very isolated and clean, and they've been organic since, you know, 1970, and they also really understand how to rotate a field, and they've grown ancient grains before because it's hard to grow. And the great thing about where these farms are located is it's extremely dry from, you know, May to July. So we don't have to worry about any types of molds or mycotoxins in the grains.
And that's one of the problems with wheat sensitivity, isn't it? It's not just the wheat itself, that there's it's molds and mycotoxins.
There are in all kinds of grains, you know, and these are things that people don't really know. And so it's really my job to be aware of this and look out for my customers, you know. And so we make those, my husband and I make these judgment calls, and it's for my family, and, you know, we want to make sure that all of our products are, you know, as best they can be.
Right, so that's one of the things to be concerned about. And one of the things you see is certainly mold and mycotoxins, and something I explore with my patients. There's a researcher and author, Richie Shoemaker, a physician who works with biotoxins and mycotoxins. And one of the things he tells people, if he thinks they have mold toxins in their body, you got to go on a low amylose diet. You got to go on a low starch diet. And so part of it is the starchy foods. Mold obviously likes to eat starch. But
right.
also, there's mold on the starch,
mm-hmm.
and so that's an issue. So you actually have a farm. So you're all of the Einkorn that you sell, you're actually growing in Italy.
We do.
Is anybody growing Einkorn anywhere else in the world?
There are some people growing Einkorn in the United States.
Uh-huh.
I haven't really had much contact with anybody here, but there are. I'm aware of a few places where it's being grown.
Right, but mm-hmm. probably not in New England.
Not really sure of locations.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they, right, so because again, as you said, they would have to be somewhere dry where you're unlikely to be contaminated.
You can grow it in New England, but, you know, you never know. I mean, right now it's been humid out, you know, 100%, whatever, 80% humidity every day.
Right.
And that's just not good for wheat.
Right. And that's why, as you said, that's why they grow it in the Midwest, because you just don't have this kind of humidity. We're 30 miles from the ocean here.
We are.
That's the issue. And that's the benefit of that is that you get a lot of lushness here. There's certain kind of plants that thrive in that.
You do.
But not grains so much.
No.
Yeah, because they tend to get moldy. And
right.
mold is a huge issue for people around here. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I deal with a lot. So so one of the things, now, do you still have a facility in Italy where you do those culinary getaways?
We do.
Yes, we
it's basically a week-long vacation. You can pick an Einkorn week or a gluten-free week. And it's cooking classes, there's some sightseeing, and basically a group of 20-some people who get together with me. And we go through baking bread, sourdough bread, making pasta, traditional Italian food, and some pastries. And we've been doing it since 2012.
Nice.
And it's been a really great experience for me to meet people and to, you know, directly, because you don't really meet people when you're in a business like this, and learn from my customers. And it's been really nice to forge some friendships and have people come back. So it's really a special place, and I've learned a lot from living in Italy, and I like to share that with people.
Yeah.
Any thoughts of doing that in North Stonington?
Well, that's one of the things that we're working on. So I'm working on a plan for the property this summer, actually. And then it will take about 2 years to restore the buildings. They're in pretty bad shape. And obviously the house, the main home, was built in 1685, so you need a certain type of person, you know, to do the restoration work on that.
Wow.
And but some pretty exciting things, I think, are going to come out of this property.
Oh,
yeah.
I think it will be really
exciting.
Well,
we're waiting. We're excited to see.
Yeah, I'm excited too. You know, I can't wait. But a lot of work to do, but we're getting that into motion soon. So I'm excited about that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so exciting. So, so you do a lot of cooking now. When in terms of your family and in terms of Julia, you've found ways to cook healthy for your family. I'm assuming, and so I'm guessing that most of the time you're cooking healthy, right?
We pretty much cook all the time at my house, and we don't eat out much. And I think my style of cooking is pretty simple. You know, my children don't like things to get too complicated, and I've learned in Italy that it's nice to kind of separate things. And, you know, we all in my family have food sensitivities, so we like to, you know, eat a single vegetable and a protein and not kind of mix a lot of things up together. And just really focus on good ingredients, and that's really what makes every meal delicious.
So do you have tips for busy families who want to cook healthier? What's one thing that someone could start with if they wanted to cook more healthfully for their family?
I think in Italy people have a nice balance of you know, grains and proteins and vegetables at every meal. They don't tend to eat a lot of carbohydrates at night. They eat those more in the morning or at lunchtime. And I think eating seasonal can solve a lot of problems, because if you eat a vegetable for a few months and you don't eat it for a year, it's hard to build up a sensitivity to foods like that. So I think Italians always eat seasonal and fresh. So I think if you're living in a place like New England, it's so crucial to get to a farmer's market in the summer and not keep eating the vegetables at the supermarket that have been in the refrigerator and come from really far away.
Right.
You know, you need that. And so I think, you know, simple is really the way to go if you're busy and, you know, you have a little piece of fish, or, you know, it depends on what type of protein you have in a vegetable. At night, keep it simple, eat early, go to bed almost hungry. You know, that's kind of the Italian way of eating.
Right, right. So they tend to eat their supper a little bit earlier than we do here.
It's a different curve, you know.
Yeah.
You start out, and then it grows, and it definitely drops off. And so a lot of times they'll just have a little soup or, you know, a piece of toast and a piece of cheese and a little fruit, and you walk away from the table almost hungry.
Right.
And I think that's a huge difference between the way we do it here, because we work and we get home and we're hungry, and so dinner is really our biggest meal.
Right. Well, and don't they have a different work day than we have?
It's turning into the American work day, but they still kind of keep up with that schedule. And I think the other thing that they do is they keep things balanced. You know, I've seen people eat huge bowls of pasta or, you know, large pieces of steak, or, you know, they never really do that. Everything is kind of very proportionate and small.
Right.
Know? So eat in moderation, I think, and variety is key. Keep introducing different things in your diet. Don't be stuck on the same lunch every day for, you know, 5 years, and that's what gets you into trouble.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we see, that people, when I was in school, we talked about that, how people tend to mono-eat, that they often eat no more than 10 foods. And then when they find out they have food intolerances, they talk about how, for example, I hear this all the time, gluten is in everything. And if gluten were in everything, I would be skinny. I'd be really skinny. I'm not really skinny. I definitely find things to eat. And gluten isn't everything if all you eat is processed food.
Right.
And even then, it isn't in everything. You have to find it. And one of the things people do is they're eating an excessively starchy diet to start with, And so what they do is they swap out their excessive starches for their gluten-free counterparts and find that they're spending a lot of money and they're not really ahead of the game in terms of nutrition.
Right. I think you're right.
Yeah, and if you take the typical American who wraps their brain around the, what do you say, Fran? Cereal in the morning, sandwiches.
Yeah, cereal for breakfast, sandwiches for lunch, and pasta for dinner.
Right,
yeah.
So there's just a whole bunch of, you know, really starchy food involved there,
right.
Which is why Americans look starchy.
I don't think, you know, you have to go to extremes unless you really have a serious problem, but I think definitely if you eat gluten for lunch, don't eat it for dinner, you know.
Right.
It's important to change things up and give your body a break for a few hours.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's important to not eat for a while. Not everybody can do that because there's people who have issues with hypoglycemia, but most people can do that. I mean, the people who are going to have trouble with hypoglycemia are people who are have a very high metabolism and are very naturally thin, like you, Ron. Yeah. But you're unusual. And most people could go for a period of time without eating, which is this idea of going to bed almost hungry makes sense because you're starting your nighttime fast at a reasonable hour. And one of the things people don't realize is that when you spend time not eating, it's like when they block off the road to do construction. When there's no food coming down the turnpike, you can do repair and regeneration and restructuring and restructuring and absorption.
And I think some people, you know, kind of believe in Italy, you know, sort of like 4:30 is the carbohydrate cutoff time.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a book, Pamela Peake, Fighting Fat After 40, and that was her thing. She was a big believer in carbohydrates in the morning, and she, I think her cutoff time, you said 4:30?
I think
her cutoff was 3 p.m. She said, and it was a similar idea, keep your carbohydrates early in the day and do more protein and vegetables at night.
You know, I think another difference between the Italian lifestyle and the American lifestyle is how much people walk around there.
Right.
It's hard to find a parking space. You know, you're constantly walking and moving around. And so I think, you know, you can make some mistakes in your diet, and your physical exercise can make up for that a little bit, you know?
Right.
So that's important, too, you know? I think with, you know, the internet and everything, people are getting more sedentary. It's more common to just get home and, you know,
plug in.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe you should get up and take a walk or do something, you know? I think that's important, too.
Well, I was having a conversation yesterday with a patient about... she was having some non-specific digestive complaints, and she works very hard at keeping it healthy and working on which are her food intolerances. I didn't know how much of her issue was stress and how much of it is, you know, that she had some issues previously and they're sort of perpetuating themselves. And one of the things I asked her to do was to go for an evening constitutional, because that's something that people do. They'll have dinner early-ish,
always.
And they'll go for a walk.
Go for a walk.
Right.
Yeah, they always do. My husband used to comment, you know, we'd be walking through a neighborhood and he'd say, God, if we were in Italy, everybody would be out.
And that's a nice time to see people.
It is. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who preserve themselves well in Italy. You know, you can see, you know, old men in their, you know, early 80s who look great, you know. And I think those people, you never see them sit down. They're gardening, they're riding their bike, they're, you know, they just keep active.
Ron, do you have any questions for Carla about bicycles in Italy?
I have 1,000 questions about bicycles in Italy.
I don't know if I can answer them.
Yeah.
Well, just give us an idea, because we're not going to have you on bicycle talk, so we'll ask you a couple questions.
Well,
anyway,
I can just tell you my opinion of bicycles in Italy because I live on a country road, and a million bicycles drive by my, you know, down my street every day.
Yay.
And, it's basically you can. It takes about maybe 5 minutes to go up to 200 meters in elevation to where I live, and then another 300 meters in elevation is just a couple of miles down the road. So it's very hilly, and a lot of times you'll see these bikers, and they're going up a hill that I would probably never be able to go up. And I turn my head, and they're 80 years old.
Isn't that great?
When you see their face, they have the wrinkles, and I'm like, oh my God.
That's beautiful.
And, I think riding a bike in Italy is, you know, just groups of men, groups of women, couples, they're talking, they're riding their bike. It's everywhere.
That's how we do it here. You know, we do the same thing. It's a lifestyle.
It's
just an entirely different thing.
So when they're riding, are they out riding for exercise or are they riding socially?
I think it's both. I think they can't live without the exercise because once you do it, you know, you get hooked on it. And then it's definitely social. You don't see many people riding their bikes by themselves in Italy. It's always a group.
Yeah,
whether
I mean, that's the way
friends,
we do it.
Two guys.
People are more social there anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you see really high-end bikes or do you see more, workaday bikes?
No, they've got all kinds. Yeah, I think they've got some pretty good equipment. And
really?
They love hills. You know, that's the thing. That's what you do on Sunday. You wake up, you live in the city, you drive your bike to the top of a hill that's way up there, and then you drive home for your dish of pasta. I mean, that's what everybody does.
Oh, it sounds great.
Oh, my goodness.
It sounds great.
And they're riding fancy Italian bikes. They're not riding, like, just little hybrids. Or they're riding, like, road bikes.
It's probably a mix, I'm sure, like it is here.
Yeah, it depends where you go. There's mountain bikers, too.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
Yeah. But
so they're on the Bianchis and the Colnagos and the
Pinarellos. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. But you know what? Those are like the generic bikes over there. They're probably, the people that are real serious are riding from a small custom frame builder.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a small custom frame builder tucked away in almost every town
in
Italy.
There is. We have a couple in my town.
Yeah. Isn't that great? I mean, it's just such a different culture there.
We're going. That's it. We're going.
I want to go.
We're going to go.
I want to go.
Yeah.
We should go.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, that's beautiful. So Ron, Carla lives in a place where they grow really wonderful food.
Mm-hmm.
She teaches people to cook really wonderful food. Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful there, and everyone rides a bike.
No offense, but I'm already in love with her.
No.
It's a great place.
It sounds like heaven.
Yeah, it does.
It really does.
Well, it sounds right.
I think Italian people know how to enjoy themselves.
Yes.
And I don't think they feel guilty when they do enjoy themselves.
No, that's
nice.
True.
You know, I think
very
that
nice.
They feel like you should relax. You should take care of yourself. And, I think that's it's a different type of concept, I think.
Culture and lifestyle is so different here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah.
We're, you have to work. You're always chasing the buck and you're always working.
Exactly.
We're always pushing.
And it's stressful. Yeah, and I often talk about, just the Southern way, that you have to have a porch and a rocking chair and you sit and sip your iced tea. And I always say I want to do that, and I don't get around to it. It's so sad. And I think, Ron, you and I need to, like, start doing happy hour or something.
I'm good with that.
Okay.
I'd be very happy
with
that.
We'll sit and have a drink.
Yeah.
You know, a little something.
Yeah, and you can have a summer drink out on the deck.
Right.
You know, it's
good
nice
idea.
Out.
Yeah.
Put your feet up. Take a deep breath.
It just sounds really amazing. And it's amazing that it turned out that, you know, I saw that this company was up and coming, Jovial, and I heard you not too long ago on Faith Middleton with on the Food Schmooze.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
that's
fun
great.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she has been talking about your company for years as well.
Yeah.
And very excited about it.
She's
and
a great supporter of us. We're lucky to know her.
That's great. Yeah, that's really wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. So you're thinking you're going to do these, I know you're doing the culinary getaways.
We're going to do a couple events in North Stonington.
Oh, do tell.
This summer.
When?
Oh, you were?
Which we're going to announce maybe later today on our Facebook page.
Okay.
And
okay,
going to do is we're calling them Einkorn Evenings. And I think a lot of people are curious, you know, what goes on in this building, because you can see it. You know, a lot of people drive by here, and they're like, what is that? And they'd love to come back to the Randall House, and, we'd love to just get people back here, but we really can't on a big scale, but we're going to have I think it'll be about 20 people minimum, maximum. We're going to do 3 Einkorn evenings, where I'm just going to get together with people and, you know, have a conversation about Einkorn. Maybe I've met some people around who have the cookbook. Maybe they're having a hard time with sourdough starter. And we'll show them a little bit about what we do in Italy, take a tour of the facility here, and have a little tasting answer questions, just really a gathering.
Maybe before one of your evenings, I could take people out for a little bicycle ride.
Yeah. So we're going to be doing that end of July and a couple days in August.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should definitely talk.
Cool. We'll watch for it.
Okay.
Right. Because I would love to bring some of that beautiful Italian culture to this part of Connecticut, combining the food and the cycling.
I think that if we do, you know, when we do something here at Randall's, it's definitely going to be a combination of both of my worlds, because I live most of the year in Italy, but I was born in Connecticut, and I really love both places, but they're so different. And so yes. Our goal, and kind of what we did in our facility here was we kind of combined, you know, traditional New England timber frame construction, but we had, you know, some really beautiful doors made in Florence, shipped over here, and, you know, combine those two wonderful places together. And so when you come here to North Stonington, you're always going to be getting a little bit of Italy.
Right. Oh, that's incredible.
Very
and,
nice.
And North Stonington isn't even that far from the ocean.
No, it's really close.
Right.
Yeah. 15 minutes to Watch Hills.
That's right.
Place.
Oh, mm-hmm. I know. One of my favorite places to go.
Yeah.
We had an experience. I make him, he doesn't like to sit on the beach. I don't know why you wouldn't want to sit on the beach, but okay. But anyway, I make him take me on a bike ride and go down to Westerly. And, of course, Ron looks like an old Italian guy, a skinny old Italian guy. And we ride Italian bikes. He was a rep for Bianchi. And so we're on our Bianchi bicycles. And we stopped in Westerly and, you know, we propped up our bikes to go get a snack. And the old Italian dudes in Westerly, they looked at Ron, and the way they looked at him, they sort of nodded and smiled at him in a really knowing way, because he looked like, you know, an Italian guy in a bicycle. You know, one of those people that you would see, like you talked about, back in Italy.
And it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All makes sense.
Now, have you been to Italy before?
No, never.
Oh, are you kidding?
Oh, I wish I was kidding.
Oh,
yeah, no.
Oh,
I do. I have, you know, I have relatives in Italy that are, they're up in Senegalia, up in that area.
Oh, that's pretty.
And yeah,
well, kind of near where my grandparents were born.
Oh, really?
Oh,
beautiful
yeah.
area. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have relatives up there, and I've been told that region is specific to my last name.
The Menizes only
you won't
come
find them
from.
Anywhere else
that's right.
In Italy.
They're from Senegalia, and that's it.
Yeah. Interesting.
So
yeah.
I'm sure if I went there, I could make a lot of friends.
It's interesting how many Americans have never traveled out of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
You really should just go.
It's a time and a money thing. That's the issue.
Wow.
It's when you're running a business.
You just got to make it happen.
You have to make it happen.
That's true. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, so we'll do that. Maybe we'll have we'll have like a 2-year plan, and then we'll go. But I mean, we can go to Randall's Ordinary anytime.
Oh, I know. I know. I understand that.
So are you going to continue to use the name Randall's Ordinary in some way?
I have no idea.
Right. Because I wonder if that's a...
you know, it might be called something like Jovial at the Randall
Home. Oh,
very
sure,
good.
Like sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to decide on that. So, you know, it's a huge economic investment.
Why did you call your company Jovial?
I think my family had been through a lot. You know, just a lot of different sicknesses and losing people at young ages and things like that. And so when I turned 40, somebody said, oh, you're in the second half of your life. And I thought, really? Well, I hope it's a good, you know, I hope it's better than the first half. And so I figured I would call the company Jovial because I hoped that I would be happy for the next 40 years.
Aw, that's
very
awesome.
Very nice.
Well, Jovial is what you would like to experience when you're hanging around with a bunch of rollicking Italian folk.
I think you do, and that's why, you know, we always have people who come back to the villa because it really is, I don't know, it's different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's like when Ron had his, that wake. You were at the wake, and right? Tell that story about the wake. Yeah.
For my aunt, yeah. It was in a funeral home in New London where... It was shared on. There were two sides of the funeral home, so they had to come over and tell us to quiet down because we were disturbing the people next door.
Yeah.
Typical Italian funeral.
Exactly.
and Ron, you're only half Italian, and your Italian side and your not Italian side they're kind of different from one another.
Right. Well, the Italian side's the good side.
Oh.
It's not revealing anymore. more information.
I'm going to leave it at that. Oh, it's the better. Goodness. It's definitely the better side.
Yeah. Too much. Yeah. They have too much fun. It's a good time.
Great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've been able to meet some of them. So you said something really interesting about Italian culture where they have pleasure without guilt.
They do. It was always strange for me. You know, my mother-in-law would be really kind of nice to me in the sense that would be like, oh, sit down for a little while. Oh, can I do this for you? Or, you know, and you would think of a mother-in-law being, you know, a little cynical towards the daughter-in-law, you know, and it was the opposite. She wanted to baby me. She wanted to, you know, and I noticed that in the culture. And I think even with celiac disease, that comes across, you know, people feel extremely sorry for you if you have celiac disease. They want you to be happy, and they've taken it on really seriously, and you can really have great, safe meals all over Italy. So I think...
So they have a feeling of hospitality.
And taking care of you, or I think they feel like you're in this world to be happy and to enjoy yourself.
That's really beautiful.
It was a foreign concept to me. I mean, I think I was a very responsible child and always, you know, taking care of all of my duties and, you know, studying. And I think when I got there, I felt like, wow, I could just go to a coffee shop and sit down for, you know, an hour.
And that's
relax.
A thing to do.
That's
an approved thing to do. It's like, why are you working so hard? Come sit down.
Right. No one's going to say, oh, are you lazy? You know,
it's no.
Just, no. And I think people there work to live.
Instead of live to work like they do in New England.
They do. And they don't really have, you know, large properties or big yards. They live pretty humble lifestyles. So they're not in the yard all Saturday and Sunday cutting their lawn and trimming their hedges. You know, they're out. They go somewhere. They live.
We're out riding our bikes.
Right.
You know, and sometimes that was different for somebody who grew up in New England. But I got used to, you know, I like it. I know, you know, you see things differently when you come from a different country and you notice things.
Sure.
And, you know, it's, I think they like... They love the land. They love, you know, having fruit trees and gardens and vegetables. And I think I fit in Italy because everything revolves around food,
yeah.
Like my own life. And I think that's normal. You know, it's normal to take a vacation. Let's say you go to Sicily and come home and your friends will say, hey, did you eat this? Or where did you eat? You know, that will be the first question.
Sure.
And I like that. I liked that food was important to everybody's life.
Well, you have to eat.
You do. But
and if you're going to eat, it might as well be a pleasure.
But it goes beyond that.
Yeah.
You know, it's more of an appreciation for things. Time to sit back and notice things and relax. And, you know, I watched my neighbor trim his grapevines for months. He has a huge property. And, you know, he said it relaxes me. But he doesn't go fast. He just takes his time and does a good job. You know, it's okay to go slow.
Yeah. That's so nice.
Yes, it is.
It's a really different thing because we're in New England where we really do have a Puritan work ethic here.
We do.
And the other thing is Italy, they're primarily Catholic. They're primarily Roman Catholic. And one of the things I read about was that Catholicism, when the Italians came to Italy, I believe the Irish preceded them, and the Irish set up their form of Catholicism in, for example, New York City or in places where, you know, they would all tend to settle. And so the Italians went to the Irish Catholic churches because they were already there, and they were astonished. Because they were a lot more pristine, they were a lot more hard line, they were a lot more, you know, unforgiving, and Italian Catholicism, that's not how the Italians roll. Yeah. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think generally they feel less guilt about anything than we do.
Well, and that's the big thing is that taking the time to not be a human doing and be a human being and enjoy your life and look around you and enjoy what's going on.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of what our company's about. It's about making foods that are okay for people who might have a dietary restriction, but making them so delicious that they can enjoy themselves anyway.
That's great. And that's what we do because Ron and I don't eat gluten and We love our food. Don't we love our food, Ron?
We do love our food.
We love to eat, and we love to eat delicious things. I will travel to get delicious things. I get very excited when I get to eat something yummy. I am not an eat-to-live person. I'm definitely a live-to-eat person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess there must be some aspect of that in Jewish culture because I got it. So, with, you know, the Jewish and the Italian, we get together and we kind of try to enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think we need a trip to Tuscany, Ron.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We do.
All right. So, Carla, it was so, we have to wrap up. We've been having so much fun talking to you. It's time.
Yeah.
So it's, I'm so grateful that you could speak with us. We're going to have to come down and have a chat with you at some point in North Stonington.
Right. Well, you're so close. Stop by anytime.
We would love to.
Yeah, we'd love to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It'd be fun.
Yeah. Right. So, so I'll get information from your people. But anyway, it was so great to have Carla Bartolucci here on Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. As we said, Carla Bartolucci and her husband Rodolfo founded Jovial Foods, which is now based in North Stonington, Connecticut. They have many wonderful einkorn products, which is an ancient wheat, an ancient form of wheat that is much less allergenic than modern wheat. And they also have many gluten-free products that are primarily made from ancient grains, as well as some packaged produce items like packaged tomatoes. And you also have some oil and vinegar as well?
We do. We have, we make an olive oil made from ancient varieties of olives.
Excellent. So it was so terrific to have you on and very educational as well. Thank you once again, Carla, for being on Radio Naturopath.
It was my pleasure.
And I'll be contacting you soon, and then we'll come and visit you.
Thanks. It would be great to see you.
All right. Take care, Carla.
Thanks
again.
Bye-bye.
All right. So you heard Carla Bartolucci here on Radio Naturopath. That was a great talk. Was that not awesome?
Oh, it was very good. Yeah. Very nice. Yeah.
So it gives you something to think about whether you, so here's the thing, here's one of the take homes, whether you should eat einkorn or not. So far what I have done is I have told people who have antibodies to gluten, that have tissue transglutaminase or to anti-gliadin antibodies, that they shouldn't eat it. If you know you don't do well with gluten, but you don't have those antibodies, it might be okay to try einkorn. It's something to discuss with somebody who knows what they're talking about. Like a good naturopathic physician or nutritionist would be the one to talk to about this. But anyway, I'm so grateful to Carla for having this company and being able to put together these products and present them in a way that's delicious and also really healthful. So that was Radio Naturopath today on July 19th, 2017. That was really good in the middle of the summer. So we have to go. So thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath.
Yes.
And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.